First, there have been a lot of civil rights movements in American history. Many of them have worked for years, even decades, to make sure that the ideals of the Declaration of Independence and the individual protections of the Bill of Rights apply equally to all citizens. Our next guest says one of the most successful civil rights movements in American history has been the campaign for corporate civil rights. It was never a sure thing that corporations would get the same rights as individual citizens, but our guest says corporations and their attorneys have made the idea of corporate personhood a more and more important concept in the legal system. And that's played out in recent Supreme Court decisions like the Citizens United ruling on campaign finance and free speech and the Hobby Lobby ruling on religious rights. Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA. His newest book is We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we dig into the history, Adam, what do we mean by the concept of corporate personhood?
Well, corporate personhood is a widely misunderstood and controversial idea. Some people think that the Supreme Court has given corporations the rights of individuals because it treats corporations just like people. But in fact, the Supreme Court has generally said that corporations, it's not that they're people, it says that they're just associations like the NAACP or the Sierra Club or even the NRA, like a membership association, and thus has the rights of its members.
And what kinds of rights, civil rights, I guess, does a corporation have in this day and age?
Well, today, corporations have nearly all the same rights as you and me. The corporations have been fighting for winning rights of the First Amendment, and today, nearly half of all First Amendment cases are brought on behalf of corporations and trade associations. Over the years, corporations have won the same rights as criminal defendants under the Constitution and rights of equality and due process.
Should they have those rights, I guess, is the big question. They get certain protections. Individuals get protections by doing things via a corporation that limits their liability in some cases. Should they get those rights that that individuals would have?
Well, 19 states have endorsed a constitutional amendment to declare that corporations have no rights under the Constitution. And while we need better laws to limit corporate influence and corporate power, I think this step might go too far, because if corporations have no rights whatsoever, the government could seize their buildings to build a highway and not pay any compensation. It could charge corporations with crimes and fine them without giving them due process of law. Indeed, even Trump could censor the New York Times and CNN, both corporations. So I think there's a middle ground, a middle road to take when thinking about the rights of corporations. They shouldn't have all the same rights as people, but they need some basic protections for their property.
Let's survey the history now. You spend a lot of time tracing how this developed through the years. And go back to the founding fathers, first of all. It doesn't look like they spent a lot of time on this idea because there weren't a lot of corporations around.
No, that's right. There is no evidence that the framers ever intended the Constitution to protect business corporations. And in fact, the founding generation harbored a certain hostility towards corporations, with Jefferson condemning what he called the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations. Yet, like others who were left out of the original promise of we the people, corporations have been fighting in the Supreme Court to win the rights that the Constitution guarantees to ordinary individuals. And they've been very successful. The Supreme Court has deviated from the original intentions of the framers when reading the Constitution to benefit and privilege the rights of corporations.
And take us into the rise of corporations, the big rail companies and others. It seems like that was the start of a big turning point.
Well, even before the railroads, the powerful corporations were going to the Supreme Court claiming constitutional protections. You know, the first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans wasn't decided until 1857. But the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations was brought a half century earlier, in 1809, and the corporation won. That corporation was the Bank of the United States, and it was the richest, most powerful corporation in America. And although we think of the Supreme Court as a bulwark to protect minorities, in truth, it's used its power over the course of American history more often to protect big business.
Talking to Adam Winkler, author of the new book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. And then take the story out further from that 1809 case into the mid to late 1800s, when these big corporations rose that I think were beyond the scope of anything the founding fathers could have imagined.
No, that's right. And yet they still claim they were entitled to the rights that the Constitution guaranteed for the most marginalized and powerless after the 14th Amendment was adopted, after the Civil War, to protect the rights of the freed slaves. Corporations went to the Supreme Court and won the same rights of equality and due process that were intended for the freed slaves. And indeed, in the first 50 years of the 14th Amendment history, there were only 28 Supreme Court cases on the rights of African Americans and 312 cases on the rights of business corporations.
A recurring theme through your book is the corporate attorney who advocates for corporations ends up being one of the most respected attorneys in the country, some cases ending up on the Supreme Court themselves.
Well, that's right. You know, corporations didn't win their rights by parading in the street like women and minorities. Instead, corporations won their rights in the Supreme Court. And when we think about corporate power, we often think about corporate influence on the legislative branch or on elected officials. But part of the story of corporate power is how the court system is uniquely designed to privilege corporations, too. They've always been able to hire the best, most experienced lawyers to make the most creative and persuasive arguments on behalf of the rights of corporations.
Let's take something a little more fundamental. Why do we have corporations? Why are they an entity recognized by the government?
Well, corporations are very long-standing institutions. So the first corporations were invented back in ancient Rome, 3 centuries before Christ. And even back then, by the way, they were polluting. We find evidence from ice core samples that the early Roman mining corporations were polluting the entire atmosphere. So even back in their earliest days, they were posing a significant threat to human beings. But corporations really took off in America in the first decade after the Constitution was founded. The Supreme Court played an important role by expanding the rights of corporations and making the corporate form a more desirable practice for American investors.
It makes sense in a way if we want to create an entity, whether it's an organization like the NAACP, as you mentioned, or a business or anything like that, that's going to survive after, say, I, the founder, retire. There needs to be some kind of mechanism to keep that alive beyond my participation in it.
That's right, and that's why the earliest corporations were founded. And indeed, one of the hard things to swallow and to understand is that actually the purpose of those corporations is really to have rights so that you can create an entity that will, say, have the right of property and be able to continue to operate even if one of the investors dies. You know, in a partnership, a more traditional kind of business organization, if one of the partner dies, traditionally you have to reorganize the whole partnership. The corporation was designed to have at least some of the rights of people so that you could keep those rights afoot even after some of the particular individuals who formed the corporation moved on or sold their shares.
Adam, you write that the development of corporate civil rights followed two paths in some ways. In some cases, it followed on the granting of civil rights for groups of individuals, like you mentioned, the 14th Amendment. In some cases, corporations were blazing new trails that other groups hadn't pursued yet. Can you talk about those two paths?
One of the most surprising things I found in researching We the Corporations is that corporations have often been innovators in constitutional law. First movers, they developed some of the most innovative civil rights litigation strategies that would be used later by the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. And corporations were behind some of the first cases to breathe life into some of our most important fundamental rights, such as the freedom of the press. Where some of the earliest and most successful and important influential cases were brought by newspaper corporations. At the same time, corporations have been first movers, but they've also been good leveragers. They've often used the reforms of progressives and the little guy to help big business.
Let's get into campaign finance now. That's been one of the more recent big issues on corporate personhood, and it goes back over a century. There was a backlash a little over a century ago against corporate donations to political campaigns. Can you talk about how that developed around 1900?
No, that's right. And, you know, we think of Teddy Roosevelt, the famous president who was a trust buster, went against the big corporations. But in truth, he was in cahoots with the big corporations. He received nearly all of his campaign financing money from big corporations. He was one of the very first presidents to receive a lot of corporate money. And a scandal involving that money led to the first campaign finance laws a century before Citizens United. Interestingly enough, those laws that restricted corporate spending in elections were challenged in courts by corporations claiming that the laws violated their constitutional rights. These were brewing companies in the run-up to Prohibition, and they wanted to take out ads against temperance. But the courts ruled back then that corporations had no right to participate in politics, that the right to influence election belonged, the one court said, to, quote, natural persons, not artificial persons.
Adam Winkler is with us. He's a law professor at UCLA, and we're talking about his new book coming out tomorrow. It's We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of corporate personhood? Should the rights guaranteed to individuals also apply to corporations? What do you think of the Citizens United and Hobby Lobby rulings? We'll get into those coming up. You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Law professor Adam Winkler is with us from UCLA. We're talking about his new book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. He tells the story of corporate personhood and how corporations are treated as people in many ways in the U.S. legal system. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the protections guaranteed to individual citizens by the Constitution and amendments thereof should also apply to corporations? Is it time to rethink the way corporations exist in our legal system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to a caller now. We've got Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Thank you. I just want to know the professor's comment that what a really recent, well, in the last 15, 20 years particularly, corporations' behavior of funding judicial candidates, particularly in the Wisconsin, in the state Supreme Court. So I'm a member of the Wisconsin State Bar, and many of us semi-seriously believe that Wisconsin has the finest state Supreme Court that money can buy. And I'd be interested in your guest comment.
Jim, thanks for the call. Adam, corporate donations to judicial candidates in states around the country.
Well, that's a very astute observation that the caller made. In fact, you know, we think about when we think about the effect that Citizens United, which allowed corporations the same rights as individuals to spend their money to influence elections, when we think about that case's effect, you know, sometimes our tendency is to focus on how much they spend on the latest senatorial election or a presidential election. But corporations really can spend their money and deploy it much more advantageously in smaller, less high-profile elections like judicial elections, and it's been a recurring problem where corporations are getting their candidates elected to state Supreme Courts and getting favorable rulings from them.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I had a question about the corporations and the Citizens United. I think Citizens United, if the idea is that money is speech, then that's a very corrupt idea to a democracy because money amplifies speech. Like if you can give $300 million to a political candidate, that makes your voice more louder than mine if I don't have that kind of money. So I think that's a corrupting influence. And the other thing I wonder about is, how about international corporations? They have, through international investors, would have political influence on our democracy without being citizens of this democracy.
Willem, thanks for the call. Adam?
Well, that's right. One of the problems with Citizens United is that not only has it lifted the limits on corporate spending on elections, it's lifted the limits on individual spending in elections and led to a tremendous amount of new money coming into the electoral process, much of it dark money that we don't know where exactly it comes from. Citizens United also allows foreign nationals who own stock or own foreign businesses own United States companies through shells or conglomerates or whatnot, often to have an indirect influence on our elections. So the Supreme Court has really opened up a lot of loopholes in our campaign finance laws by striking down the ban on corporate spending on election ads.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Adam, staying on Citizens United, as you said just a little while ago, courts 100 or so years ago upheld limits on corporate spending on political campaigns. Now the Supreme Court has allowed it. What has changed? How has this issue changed over time?
Well, one of the surprising influences that led to the change was Ralph Nader and his consumer rights organization, Public Citizen. In the early 1970s, in their fight for consumers, they brought a case to the Supreme Court on behalf of consumers, and they said that they persuaded the Supreme Court to adopt what's known as the listener's rights theory of the First Amendment. So the idea that the First Amendment protects speech regardless of the identity of the speaker. Well, that very argument was used by the majority in Citizens United to say that corporations had free speech rights too, because what mattered was the value of the speech to the listeners, not the identity of the speaker.
Talking to Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA, and we're talking about his newest book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. And Adam, you write in your book that Ralph Nader was influential in another way. He led campaigns to bring new regulations that affected corporations, and that set off a multi-decade backlash against it.
Well, that's right. I mean, there have been a large shift in American politics. And when Ralph Nader was at the height of his popularity in the early 1970s, there was a huge wave of consumer rights, environmental laws, all sorts of new progressive laws being adopted, from the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act to protections against poorly designed automobiles. That led future member of the Supreme Court, Lewis Powell, to write a memorandum to the Chamber of Commerce just months before he himself was appointed to the Supreme Court. That memorandum would become a very influential planning document for the new right that would arise in the 1970s, designed to protect the interests of business, to fight back against consumers like Ralph Nader. And then Lewis Powell ended up becoming an influential Supreme Court justice who ruled in important cases that corporations did have a right to participate in electoral politics some 30 years before Citizens United.
And did I read in your book that in his enrobement ceremony, I guess, as a Supreme Court justice, when he was given his robe, it was by a Philip Morris executive?
One of the most amazing discoveries I made when I was researching We the Corporations was I found these old files from Philip Morris, which was the tobacco company that Lewis Powell was on the board of directors of when he was nominated to the Supreme Court. And they did a big send-off, a multimedia tribute to him as he was leaving the board. At the end of this send-off, the chairman of Philip Morris calls Lewis Powell up to the stage and then literally robes him, puts his black robe, Supreme Court Justice robe, on him. So we literally have the corporation's justice who receives his robe from one of the most powerful and influential corporations in America.
I'm going to go back to our callers now. Jerry is with us in Madison. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I'm calling to ask about the chartering of corporations. My understanding was that originally corporations were chartered for a specific, some mostly narrow purpose, and they could not enter into business beyond that.
Adam, corporate charters.
Yes, that's right. For the longest time, corporations had to receive a special charter from the government in order to operate. And that charter would be very limited and pose real strict restrictions on what corporations could do. That ended for corporations about 100 years ago with the rise of general incorporation laws. But even before that, one of the interesting things I found in my book is that the chartering process itself influenced the shape of the Constitution. Some of the earliest colonies were organized as corporations with a corporate charter. And that idea of a written document that would limit what the people who work for the corporation could do ultimately becomes and influences the idea of a written constitution that would specify the limits on what office holders could do.
Thanks, Jerry. Let's go now to Frank in Onalaska. Frank, hi.
Hi, fascinating subject. I think I'll have to check out the book. I'd like to hear the author's thoughts on the if a corporation or the CEO is found to be guilty of a criminal action, what's the history of you can't throw the corporation in jail, and they seldom, you know, throw the CEO or chief financial officer in jail.
Frank,
how has that evolved?
I want to jump in. Adam, are people at a corporation legally accountable? Do they end up in prison for crimes of the corporation?
Well, they can, but it doesn't happen so often. And for most of history, corporations were not deemed to be liable for a criminal offense because they were thought not to be able to create the malicious intent that a crime usually requires. However, about 120 years ago, that really started to shift. And as corporations became bigger and more powerful, we realized that criminal law could be one of the things that could be used to restrain the corporate behemoths of the Gilded Age. But it posed a really interesting question. If corporations could be charged with crimes, were they entitled to the rights that the Constitution protects for criminal suspects and criminal defendants? We forget, when thinking about the Constitution, that most of the Bill of Rights was about criminal defendants' rights. And the question came before the Supreme Court, did corporations have those same rights too?
Thanks for the call, Frank. Briefly, as we wrap up, Adam, you write about an expansion of corporate civil rights over the years with some turnaround, some setbacks over the years. Do you think the pendulum is maybe going to swing the other way?
Well, we are seeing signs of a backlash with 19 states supporting a constitutional amendment to declare that corporations have no rights. And we have large bipartisan majorities that think corporations have too much power and decisions like Citizens United are wrong. However, I see that for the short term, at least, the Supreme Court seems pretty committed to protecting the rights of corporations and, in fact, has a very important case in front of it right now, a case called Masterpiece Cake Shop, on whether a for-profit bakery in Colorado can refuse to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple. The rights of corporations are maybe here to stay.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
That's Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA. We've been talking about his new book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eric there shared a quote from the Devil's Dictionary by Ambrose Bierce, corporations, an ingenious device for acquiring individual profit without individual responsibility. You can weigh in with your thoughts, again, on the Ideas Network Facebook page.